very neat and tidy.
Wish this case was, Will said. He glanced at his watch. We need to talk to the chief.
I'll meet you outside, Nick said.
Actually, we need you to be there, Corinna said. Will talked to Chief Causey earlier today, and he wants to meet you and get a copy of your credentials.
Sure, Nick said, sounding cautious. Is there a problem?
No, but since the press has started making calls, Causey wants to make sure all I's are dotted and T's are crossed. I'm also making another push for a task force, using Dylan's informal profile to back it up.
Because he's going to kill again.
Seems likely. But maybe if we get the manpower we need, we can stop him before he becomes the textbook definition of a serial killer.
Soundlessly, she cried, as he washed her body.
I didn't mean to hurt you like that, he told Becca, as he washed the streaks of blood from between her legs.
The water was tepid, neither hot nor cold, but her body trembled, making the water ripple.
He stroked her hair, kissed her cheek, ran a hand over her breasts, scrubbed her body with a rag and soap.
Lots of soap.
Rinsed her well. You were very good.
Not like the whore.
You were sweet and fresh and new. All for me.
When he'd penetrated her the first time, he'd realized she was a virgin. He'd come instantly. The knowledge that he'd be the first and the last man to have her, providing such intense excitement, he didn't want to hold back. She strained against the gag.
Don't do that. You'll make it hurt more. You can't tell anyone what happened.
She shook her head back and forth, her eyes wide. She tried to say something, guttural sounds rumbling in her throat. He didn't understand her, but he didn't have to. She'd just lie to him. All women, even beautiful virgins like Becca, lie. She'd say she wouldn't tell. But the first thing she would do is go to the police and tell them who he was. Obviously, he couldn't allow that to happen. He washed her hair and poured water over her head. She breathed heavily, tears running from her eyes.
I'm sorry. It has to be done.
He motioned for her to get up.
Walk back to the bed, he told her.
Her entire body shook, water dripping off her to the floor. He walked behind her with a towel, one he bought just for her. Brand new. Never been used. Suddenly, she ran for the door.
No!
He took three long strides, but she had the door open and ran down the hall. He was faster. He caught her before she even touched the front door. He threw her body down on the floor. Her head hit the coffee table, and he saw blood on her scalp. He'd have to clean the table later. She struggled as he picked her up, and she scratched his neck. He held her tight, brought her back to his bed. She fought and cried as he tied her up, her hands above her head and her feet to the posts at the end of the bed. His breathing was rapid, his face flushed with the exertion. And if he thought about it, the excitement of chasing her. He'd been scared, very scared, for a minute, but he couldn't ignore the rush when he caught her, subdued her, brought her back to his bed and tied her up. He looked at the hand that had scratched him. He couldn't see anything under her nails. She had barely even broken his skin, but that didn't mean something wasn't there. He had to be careful. He took a sharp knife and cleaned under her fingernails. She bled. He then held her hand in a bowl of bleach. A guttural scream reverberated in her chest, and he watched her vocal cords and the small, thin bones strain against her neck.
I'm sorry, he said.
He hadn't wanted to hurt her, but she had tried to escape. He took the time to flush the bloody bleach down the toilet and carefully wash the bowl. Then he returned to Becca, plastic wrap in hand. He started at her feet, slowly, carefully, wrapping Becca's body. First one leg, then the other. Her butt, everything but her vagina. Her waist, around and around. Her breasts, then each arm. And to be safe, he wrapped her again. His entire body quivered with excitement. He looked in her eyes and saw fear. "Good night, Becca." He rolled on a condom and pushed himself into her with one stroke. Her body jerked beneath him. He brought the plastic, heavy-duty garbage bag from his nightstand, pulled it over her head, and tied it around her neck. Then, he laid on top of her as her body convulsed beneath him. This time, he was done when she was. Chapter 18. Angie's memorial service was held at a funeral home near the college, in the middle of the business district. More than 100 people crowded into the chapel, waiting for the service to begin. To Corinna, it was particularly depressing that so many in attendance were young. And at the front of the room, poor Angie lay in her coffin. Will touched Corinna's arm.
"I'm sorry I have to bail on you. My flight leaves in 2 hours. I'd better hightail it to the airport."
She squeezed his shoulder. "Keep that scumbag in prison where he belongs. That's part of our job, so don't worry about it." She glanced over to where Nick and his brother were in a quietly heated conversation. "Nick can fill in for you until you return."
"Hmm."
She jerked her head back to Will and narrowed her eyes. "What's that supposed to mean?"
"What's what?" He was grinning.
"That, hmm."
"You're reading way too much into my non-comment."
"We've been partners for over a year. Friends for even longer. I know you."
"And I know you."
Will looked over her shoulder at Nick.
"I don't make it a habit to check out men, but he seems smart and reasonably good-looking. Not as handsome as yours, truly, of course, but men of my attributes are rare."
She rolled her eyes. "Don't you have a plane to catch?"
Will laughed. "He's a good cop. The chief was impressed with his background. I like him, too."
"Ask him out on a date when you get back," she snapped.
"I think you're more his type."
"Go away."
"Going, going. Be careful, okay?"
"I promise." Will left, and Corinna walked over to Nick and Steve.
"I don't like being treated like a suspect by my own brother,"
Corinna overheard Steve say to Nick before he saw her. He glared at Corinna.
"Detective Kincaid," he snapped.
"I don't mean to interrupt, but Hooper left, and I need to talk to you, Nick." She eyed Steve suspiciously. She flat out didn't like him. Though he'd moved down on the suspect list, his attitude about his affair with Angie and the other college girls left her with a sour taste in her mouth. She certainly wouldn't want him anywhere around Lucy, though she suspected her sister had a good head on her shoulders, and wouldn't be sweet-talked by a guy twice her age, regardless of how attractive or clean-cut. Steve opened his mouth to speak, then shut it and walked away. Corinna watched as he spotted Angie's friends, Abby, Jody, and Kayla. The foursome embraced. Nick tensed beside her.
"I'm sorry," she began. "Will left, and I wanted to point out the undercover team, since you're not familiar with our people."
"I saw them."
She raised an eyebrow.
"I guess we're not as discreet as I thought."
He grinned at her. "Maybe I'm just better than you thought."
She hadn't thought of Nick Thomas as much of a joker. She liked the lighter side of him. But a memorial service was no place for lightness. His humor dissipated as he kept his eye on his brother.
"You know," she said, "he's not guilty."
"I know."
She watched Steve Thomas closely. Angie's friends certainly didn't look scared of him. Kayla was a bit standoffish, but that was her personality. Rough and prickly. Abby and Jody, on the other hand, constantly touched his arm, his back. Jody left her hand on his forearm, leaned over, and whispered something in his ear, then kissed his cheek. Dylan's explanation of why Angie was attracted to older men made sense, even if Corinna herself couldn't relate to the girl. But Abby? Jody? They were from traditional families. Didn't seem to have the same dysfunctional issues that Angie had dealt with. As she observed Steve, she realized it was him.
he didn't act like a man nearing 40. There was no difference in the way he acted and dressed than any of the other college guys who'd come to pay their respects. She remembered Dylan pointing out that he would have assumed, based on action and demeanor, that Nick was the older brother. She'd thought he was, too. The two brothers couldn't be more different. Steve was gregarious, friendly, talked to everyone, and fit in with the students, though he was substantially older than most of them. The sheriff, on the other hand, was aloof, serious, focused on his task. Even now he was scanning the room, discreet. On the outside he appeared casual, but she felt his rigid posture, his intense, subtle perusal of each person who walked up to the casket. Corinna couldn't read Nick's expression, which bugged her. She prided herself on being able to read people.
I guess things are still strained between you and your brother.
You could say that.
Were you too close before this?
He shrugged. Not as close as when we were kids.
Why's that?
Living in different states.
Why didn't he return to Montana when he was put on disability?
Why does this sound like an interrogation?
It's not. Just a conversation.
Hmm. He wasn't answering her questions, so she changed focus. She was curious about Nick Thomas. Far more curious than simple professional interest.
How long have you been sheriff?
Nearly 4 years.
Before that?
Deputy.
For how long?
8 years. Getting Nick to answer questions was like pulling teeth. Either he really didn't want to talk, or he was truly a man of few words. She'd thought they'd broken through this reticence over the last few days they'd been on the same team. You?
11 on the force. Made detective 15 months ago. I dropped out of college to join the police academy.
The corner of his mouth lifted. I dropped out of law school, for the same reason.
Law school?
She looked at his profile. Ruggedly handsome, tan from spending a lot of time outdoors.
I don't picture you as a lawyer.
He shrugged. I guess I didn't either. Was that regret in his voice?
What happened that you changed your mind?
He didn't answer right away. Then, I didn't like the idea of sitting at a desk all day. He looked right at her, and Corinna swallowed. There was something very intense about Sheriff Nick Thomas. It wasn't the first time she'd felt the brunt of his scrutiny, and it was a little unnerving, a little heady, sexy. That, and I wanted to help troubled kids, he said. You know the type. Good kids in bad situations. One thing led to another, and I joined the sheriff's department. He gave her a half grin that made her insides melt. What about you? He asked. Why'd you drop out of college? Her answer to that had always been flip, to spend more time on the waves. But the truth was that she'd spent more time in the ocean during her 3 years of college than the last 11 years on the police force.
Someone I loved was murdered.
Nick inched closer to her. He didn't touch her. But she felt the caress in his voice, more powerful than any physical connection. I'm sorry. Violence changes lives. Everyone evil touches is affected. She couldn't pull her eyes from his. The depth of compassion, of pain, of understanding. Outside of her family, she'd never found anyone who truly understood how she felt, why she'd needed to be a cop. Nick did.
My nephew, she whispered. He was 7.
Nick's jaw clenched. Did they catch the bastard? Corinna shook her head, turning away as unwanted tears sprang to her eyes. Nick squeezed her shoulder, briefly, but with strength. She took a deep breath. What do you think of that guy over there? Nick didn't point. He barely gestured, but Corinna read him like a lifelong partner. A young man stood alone, separate from the crowd,
half obscured by a potted palm. Just shy of 6 feet tall, lanky, wearing slacks and a button-down. As they watched, he approached Angie's mother, who sat looking shell-shocked in front of the closed casket. They'd spoken to Mrs. Vance earlier in the day, sharing the bare minimum information they could, while still honestly answering her many questions. The pain and anguish in Mrs. Vance's eyes, learning about her daughter's sexual activities, had broken Corinna's heart. Already, the chief of police was fielding calls from the press, which had begun to sensationalize the case. Corinna would have given her right arm to protect the Vance family from the media onslaught, but there was nothing to be done. The media seemed to think freedom of the press meant freedom to be callous. Angie's mother blinked, then jumped up and wrapped her arms around the man who'd approached. "Friend? Relative of the family?" Nick asked, almost to himself.
"Probably. But it was a good call. Solitary male, under 30, watching the crowd."
Corinna's radio beeped, and she spoke into it.
"I need to check with the team outside. I'll be back in 10.
Nick watched Corinna briskly exit the room. She was an interesting woman, full of confidence, drive, intelligence, driven by her nephew's death, though it didn't consume her. She had allowed his sympathy when offered, accepting it, without bristling or complaint. He admired that. It took a strong woman to accept sincere condolences and not go on the attack. If he was in a better place in his life, if he knew where he was going, what he was doing with his career, Corinna would be the type of woman he'd like to get to know. Intimately. Lord knew he needed a woman who didn't have baggage that weighed more than his. Nick watched Steve's neighbor, Ava, enter the room, glance around, and make a beeline toward Steve when she spotted him in the corner, surrounded by a large group of girls. Steve's face lit up when he saw her, and they hugged. Platonic? No. They may not have had sex, but there was an affair of the heart going on. What did these girls see in Steve? Sure, he was attractive and in shape. He was obviously attentive and liked to have fun. But wouldn't they be more interested in boys their own age? Nick had been around college students most of his career, and had never wanted to date any of them. But he'd pretty much spent most of the last 10 years in love with one woman. A woman who couldn't return his feelings. A woman he had voluntarily walked away from, hoping she'd follow him. She hadn't. He approached the group, standing aloof, not wanting to become involved, but Ava motioned for him to come over and made a space for him.
"We were just talking about who could have done something like this to Angie." "We know Steve didn't do it,"
one of the girls said.
"I can't believe the police even talked to him like he was a criminal."
Another girl squeezed Steve's arm.
"You're okay, right? They didn't hurt you, did they?"
"No, no, nothing like that. The police really want to find Angie's killer. Since I'm her ex-boyfriend, it's logical they would look at me first. I understand that. But now that they know I didn't do it, they can focus on finding the real killer."
Nick watched the interaction, his complex feelings about Steve and his behavior weighing heavily. Steve glared at him, the accusation of distrust in his expression hitting Nick hard. He said,
"Excuse me,"
and went to find Corinna. He needed fresh air. Chapter 19. Corinna fidgeted as she drove with Nick from the police station to her parents' house, 20 minutes east, in an older, established San Diego neighborhood. It was 9 o'clock. And the memorial service had been a bust, at least as far as learning anything about Angie's killer was concerned. All the guests had arrived safely and left unharmed. Between herself, Nick, and the undercover cops, they'd matched up every guest with a friend or relative in the room. No one looked out of place. No one lurked in the bushes. No one wrote "slut" on the bathroom wall. She felt like it had been a complete waste of time. She slammed her fist against the steering wheel.
"What are you frustrated about?" Nick asked.
"Nothing happened."
"You wanted someone to be abducted?"
"No. I just wanted him to show up, so I could nail the bastard to the wall."
She glanced at him, saw the bemused expression on his face, and lost some of her anger.
"I'm good at that, you know? Apprehension?"
"Yeah. Women cops have all the tricks. They have no qualms about hitting low because they don't know how much it hurts."
"Oh, yes, we do. That's why it's so much fun."
"Our presence at Angie's funeral could have prevented an abduction."
"Yeah, but..."
"Seriously. He could have driven by, seen our people, even undercover. Killers have a sixth sense about cops, I'm convinced of it. And even if he only made one cop, he wouldn't be stupid enough to stay."
"Or made us, and decided to stay and gloat."
"That's a possibility, too. If it's someone close to her."
"You don't think so?"
"I think he knew her, but wasn't close to her. I think he's going to attack again. When or where, I have no idea. The butcher only killed women in the spring. He sometimes waited 2 full years between kills."
"If you think I'm frustrated now, just watch me if I have to wait a year to get this guy. I don't like unsolved cases."
"You've never had one?"
"A couple. That's why I hate them."
"What about this sand shack?"
She frowned.
"I don't understand what you mean."
"That deleted email Angie mentioned to Steve. She thought the poster knew her identity because it implied that he knew where she worked."
"And you're thinking our perp could be someone connected to the shack?"
"Connected, maybe. Or a regular customer."
"That makes sense. What if he already knew Angie and then stumbled across her online diary? Because of something he knew about her personally, he was able to make the connection."
"It's plausible," Nick said. "But why kill her?"
"Maybe he hit on her, and she rejected him. Because he thought she'd be easy, he had a fit and killed her."
"Possibly."
"You don't sound like you're buying it."
"I'm not discounting it as a theory. I agree with your brother Dylan. It was personal in some way. Which means I think he knew her, or saw her, on a regular basis."
"I feel like we're working on borrowed time, but I have no idea where else to look."
She stifled a yawn.
"I know that feeling," Nick said. "On the butcher investigation, every time we thought we had a lead, it was a dead end. We knew he would attack again. We even knew it would happen in the spring. But every time, it still shocked the town. Almost as if it were unexpected. And we scrambled, searching for a college girl who most certainly had a death sentence."
"That must have been hell."
"I'm just relieved it's over." He paused. "What happened to your nephew?"
"Justin." She'd adored her nephew. Who wouldn't have loved that little hellion? The first grandchild, the first nephew, the first of the next generation. With dimples like his mom and the statesmanship of his political dad, he would have been a heartbreaker, or president when he grew up. She missed him.
"I'm sorry I brought it up," Nick said. "I've upset you."
"I'm okay."
She pulled the car into the Kincaid family driveway and turned off the ignition.
"I just miss him. But my feelings are nothing like Nelia's, my sister. His mom. She was devastated. But she kept everything bottled up for so long. When she finally burst, it wasn't pretty. She and Andrew divorced. Then she just left. Moved to Idaho. More than anyone, my parents want her home so badly. They built the apartment you're staying in for her. But she won't come back. Maybe she can't. Maybe she just can't be anywhere near the family."
She looked up at him with tears in her eyes.
"Justin was kidnapped when I was babysitting. Taken right from his bed in the middle of the night. I didn't hear a thing.
Nick touched her cheek, and she found herself leaning into the light caress, before realizing how inappropriate it was.
"It's not your fault," he said.
"I know that, up here,"
she tapped her head, then put her hand over her heart.
"But in here, I can't help but blame myself."
He took her hand.
"What happened?"
"Nelia worked as an attorney for a defense contractor. She was working late nights, and Andrew, her husband, who was a prosecutor, was in the middle of a big case. I was in college. I could give up a few nights, study at their house. I remember that so clearly. I had 2 midterms and a swim meet. I was wiped out. My mom always watched Justin after school. He and Lucy were born a month apart. Justin loved to tease Lucy and call her Auntie Lou, though she was 27 days younger than him."
She smiled at the bittersweet memory.
"My mom thought she was in menopause and was shocked when she found out she was pregnant at the age of 45.
"Nice surprise, anyway."
"Yeah. Lucy can be a pain in the neck because she's a bit spoiled. But she's fun. And I was really happy to have a baby sister."
She didn't say anything for a long minute, and Nick didn't interrupt. She intertwined her fingers with his, and it felt right to sit here with him, touching him, sharing her worst nightmare.
"So, anyway, I picked Justin up when I got out of class. My mom said he could spend the night at the house, but I knew she and Dad were beat. I even offered to take Lucy with me."
Her voice hitched.
"But," she said, "it was a school night. So I took Justin over to his house. We ordered out for pizza. Together, Justin and I devoured an extra-large pizza with the works, minus mushrooms, because I can't fathom eating anything that is grown in animal dung." She remembered when her older brother, Connor, used to chase her around the house with mushrooms her mom bought for the spaghetti sauce.
"It's alive. It's going to conshroom you."
"We watched Star Wars together. Still the single best movie of the 20th century. I let Justin stay up past his bedtime. I was studying. Then Nelia called, said she was running later than she thought, and why wasn't Andrew home? Hell if I knew, and I told her so. I never liked him anyway. Still don't, even if he's a good DA. Then I fell asleep."
Why hadn't Justin screamed? Had the killer subdued him while he slept? There was no evidence of a struggle. Justin was just gone. And the window to his bedroom was open. Had she forgotten to check it? Nelia was a stickler for always checking doors and windows. She had been sure she'd checked it.
"I woke up to Nelia screaming, 'Corinna, where's Justin? Where's Justin?' I didn't know what was going on. I looked at the clock. It was 2 in the morning. But Justin was missing. His bedroom window wide open. No sign of forced entry."
Corinna looked at Nick, saw the sympathy and understanding in his eyes.
"Nelia blamed me for not locking the window. I thought I had. But I don't know anymore."
She took a deep breath.
"She hasn't spoken to me since."
Nick rubbed her neck. The gesture soothed her, even more than their entwined fingers, made her say more than she'd intended. She had never told anyone the whole story, not like that. It was oddly cathartic. Even though she couldn't forgive herself completely, telling Nick had helped purge something that had been eating her inside.
"I'm sorry to dump all that on you. It's probably the last thing you wanted to hear."
"No," he cleared his throat. "I'm glad you told me. I wish I had answers. The only thing I've learned being a cop is that good people get hurt, and bad people enjoy it. Our job isn't to stop the pain, but to prevent it in the future."
His hand cupped her cheek, and this time, she let herself relax, just for a minute, and savor the affection.
Suddenly, the car started moving violently up and down.
"What the hell?"
Corinna exclaimed, reaching for her gun. She looked in the rearview mirror and saw her brothers, Connor and Patrick, pushing up and down on the trunk.
"You immature brats!" she yelled,
biting back a smile.
"I'll get you back!"
"Oh, we're so scared,"
Patrick laughed.
"Come on, you might as well meet the rest of the clan,"
she told Nick, reluctantly letting his hand go. Maybe it was for the best. She'd been close to kissing him. Everything had worked exactly like he'd planned. After Becca died, he watched the webcam he'd planted in Jody's apartment and saw Abby making two drinks with the spiked Coke. Then Jody came in and made two more drinks. That was certainly enough to knock them out. At midnight, he left Becca in the library parking lot. It was fitting, really. He'd first met Angie on the beach, so he'd left her there. He met Becca at the library, so naturally, he left her there. It seemed somehow complete, finished, a circle. He couldn't imagine doing it any other way. Jody was going to be more difficult. He didn't dare leave her where he'd first met her, but he had a couple of ideas that might work. Getting into her apartment was easy enough. He'd unlocked Jody's bedroom window the day before when he'd planted the webcam. At first, he was scared. Jody wasn't in her bed. He listened, fearing the drugs hadn't worked, that Abby and Jody were awake and would scream as soon as they saw him. He listened carefully. In the apartment upstairs, the drone of a late-night talk show. In the far distance, a siren. He listened until the siren stopped. Nothing in the apartment stirred. The kitchen light was on, casting an odd glow over the living room, which had only a dim, solitary lamp in the corner. Jody was sleeping on the couch, her arm hanging over, her hair in her face. Out cold. Abby was in the chair, her head back, spittle dribbling out the corner of her open mouth. He crossed the living room, unhooked the chain on the front door, and carefully opened the deadbolt. Neither girl stirred. This was the dangerous part. But just like when he took Becca from the library parking lot, he felt an odd, rumbling thrill deep inside. He couldn't help but think he was smarter than most everyone out there. He'd broken into the apartment yesterday morning, and no one had noticed. He'd drugged their drinks, and they drank, without thinking anything was strange. There was no doubt in his mind that he could take Jody and leave the apartment without being seen. He picked her up, and she gave a slight moan. He froze, watched her face, glanced at Abby. No movement. Good. With Jody in his arms, he left the apartment as quickly as possible. To his left, he heard a group of young men coming up the street toward the apartment building. He was parked in the rear in a vacant carport, and he now quickly turned to the right, going around the building. It was late, and a weeknight. But being a building dominated by college students, there were a lot of lights still on. But most of the blinds were drawn. It took him 42 seconds to get from Jody's apartment to his car. He popped the trunk and put her in. He wanted to tie her hands, but heard the men laughing, getting closer. Where were they going? He slid into the driver's seat and pulled out, slowly, so as not to draw suspicion. While he didn't see the noisy group, he knew it had been close. He breathed easier once he got home and saw that Jody was still unconscious in his trunk. His neighborhood was quieter than Jody's, all houses pitch black, except for the old woman who lived on the corner. Her lights were always on. He wondered if she ever slept. Jody stirred when he carried her through the back door, down the hall, and into his bedroom.
"Where?"
she began, her mouth thick. She didn't open her eyes, and her head rolled back. He put her on the bed and took off her clothes.
then tied her wrists to the headboard. She squirmed again, opened her eyes, confused and disoriented.
Stop! What are you doing?
She tried to sit up, realized she couldn't, and opened her mouth wide. She was going to scream. He clamped her mouth shut with his hand. Her legs bucked and kicked. He hadn't tied them down yet. He gagged her, but she was still too loud. He didn't think anyone could hear, but he couldn't be certain. She kicked him in the chest as he tried to grab one of her ankles. He slapped her across the face. "Don't," he commanded. She didn't listen, fighting and trying to scream. But he was stronger. After some effort, he was able to restrain her. She fought against the binds, but they didn't budge. He panted heavily, catching his breath. He had wanted time alone with just her body, without her pleas, without her lies, just her beautiful, exquisite body. She'd ruined it by waking up too soon. It wasn't fair. His fingers moved down her breast, delicately brushed against her darker nipple, down her stomach, to her cunt. He spread her legs, looked at her, trying to see it all, pink and moist. She jerked and moaned out a sob. "Hi, Jody," he whispered. "Do you recognize me?" She shook her head back and forth on the bed. Anger followed the stab of pain in his heart. She didn't know him. She'd seen him at least once a week for months, had said hello to him, had smiled every time she saw him. But she didn't really see him. She looked past him, through him, around him, never at him. The phony smile, the phony hello. She didn't care about him. She never really talked to him. She didn't know him, and didn't know his name. Phony bitch. At least Angie had known who he was. She knew who killed her. He stared into Jody's eyes, willed her to remember him. He saw a spark. Something. She did know him. Now she was trying to remember where. Where had she seen him? He could practically see her pathetic, phony slut mind working. Working on the puzzle. He slid off her body and retrieved the glue from the locked drawer in his desk. He took off the lid. The smell reminded him of the last time, and his penis twitched. He walked over to her, took the large brush from the can. With one hand, he removed the gag. She screamed, and he slapped her. He painted glue on her mouth. She sputtered, gagged, tried and failed to scream as the glue clogged her throat. He tied the black bandana tight around her mouth and held it there. It hardened with the glue. Her nostrils flared as she tried to draw breath. "Calm down. If you fight it, you'll choke to death. And that wouldn't be any fun. Just calm down." He talked to her soothingly for several minutes, until he felt her pulse rate drop a bit, until her breathing became easier. "My mother warned me about girls like you," he said, after several minutes. "You tease men, lure them into your bed, fuck them, and then turn them in for rape. It happened to my father, you know. A woman just like you gave herself to him. He had sex with her, and then she went to the police. Can you believe that? Lying bitch." His dad had been in prison for 4 years and 3 months. And during that time, his mother had brought other men into her bed. She was a liar as much as the woman who talked against his dad, spreading her legs for men, all the while telling him that sex was dirty, and he'd get diseases, and his dick would fall off. He turned away from Jody. He missed his dad. He'd only been out of prison for a few months before he disappeared. Late one night, he'd walked out the door and never came back. "Mother chased him away. Daddy got mad at the way she treated him. Maybe he found out about all those men she let touch her. Why didn't you take me, Daddy? I wanted to go.
I hated her. I wanted to be with you.
Then the police came a couple days later, asking about his father. Where he was, when they'd last seen him. And that's when everything became clear. Another woman had lied about Daddy and made him go away. He'd come back when it was safe. A sound startled him, and he looked around his room. He almost didn't remember bringing Jody home, but there she was. Everything came back. He glanced at the clock. He'd been sitting there over an hour. He thought he'd have been excited to have Jody with him, but right now he was sad, thinking about his dad. Where was the thrill? He knew how to bring it back. Watch this, Jody. He put a tape in the VCR and turned the television so Jody could better see it. It was his favorite tape, the one where the guy strangled the woman with his bare hands. By the time it was over, the sadness was gone, and he was ready. He turned to Jody, not seeing the tears, her body shaking, not hearing the sobs deep in her chest. He shoved a beer bottle up her cunt and watched as she tried to scream. Chapter 20. He wore nothing but his hat. She wore nothing at all. "Come here, Corinna," Nick said in that slow, easy drawl that she now equated with rugged Montana. She walked to him. His blue eyes darkened, and he focused on her with such intensity that every muscle melted in her body. She reached for his face, pulled him down to her, touched her lips to his. His hard, lean body hovered over her, teasing, tempting, and she arched to meet him. Suddenly they were one, moving together, his hands on her breasts, her waist, wrapping her with flexing muscles, getting closer, but not close enough. "More," she whispered in his ear. The phone jolted her from her erotic dream, and Corinna moaned. "I hate my job," she muttered as she reached for the receiver next to her bed.
"Kincaid."
As she listened to dispatch, she sat up, now fully alert.
"La Jolla Main Library? I can get there in 40 minutes.
Corinna flipped the switch on her coffee pot, took a 2-minute icy shower, and with 2 travel mugs of hot coffee, drove the 2 short blocks to her parents' house and knocked on Nick's door. It was 4 in the morning. He opened it almost immediately, wearing boxers and nothing else. Wow, Nick in person was even better than in her interrupted dream. In an instant, she took in his broad chest, flat stomach, narrow hips, and scars on both knees. No time for questions about old injuries. No time to enjoy his near nakedness.
"We have another one."
"Who?" Corinna handed him one of the travel mugs of black coffee.
"We don't have a positive ID. A body, female, approximately 18 years of age, was found in the middle of the parking lot of La Jolla Public Library. A patrol found her, thought it was either a drunk or hit and run, until he approached."
"Same M.O.?" Nick zipped up his jeans and pulled a black t-shirt over his head, threaded his holster through his belt, secured his gun.
"Her head was covered by a garbage bag."
"Her head? Where's the rest of her body?"
She blinked, at first not understanding what he meant, then realizing he thought just her head was found.
"It's all there. But her body was wrapped in plastic wrap."
"Mouth?"
"Don't know. The responding officer didn't remove the bag from her head. He checked her pulse and she was dead. He secured the scene, called it in. The crime techs are meeting us there."
Nick slid his feet into boots and picked up the coffee Corinna had brought, took a sip.
"Thanks for the coffee."
"I don't know about you,"
she said as she headed down the stairs to her car, "but 3 hours of sleep doesn't cut it for me anymore." Since it was the middle of the night, with no traffic, it took less than 20 minutes to reach the library. The crime scene van was already there, but they were still unpacking their equipment. Corinna introduced Nick to Jim Gage and his assistant, Blair Duncan, who was fresh out of college. Jim pulled the case when he heard it might be related to the Vance homicide,
Blair pulled the case because she had the misfortune of being the lowest man, or woman, on the totem pole, and drew the graveyard shift. Another car drove up, and Jim said, "Did you know Dylan was coming?" Corinna glanced behind her. Dylan got out of his Lexus and walked over.
"Yeah, he's been consulting informally, though now..."
She didn't need to finish. Chief Causey had put together a small task force for Angie's funeral. Corinna would demand that they expand it after this. Two girls brutally murdered in less than a week. Corinna was certain she'd win the argument this time.
"I called missing persons on my way in," Dylan said. "A 17-year-old intern has been missing since Wednesday evening. She left the library at 8, but never arrived home. Her car was found here, in this lot, the next morning."
"Do you have a name?" Corinna asked.
"Becca Harrison."
Gage approached the victim first, while his assistant photographed the scene. When she was done visually cataloging the body and immediate surroundings, she walked in a circle outward while Gage inspected the body.
"Corinna, look at this," he said.
She approached. A plastic garbage bag had been tied with white nylon rope around the victim's neck. Her body had been wrapped with plastic wrap. Her hands were bound together by rope.
"Could it be a copycat?"
she asked, her voice unusually quiet.
"One way to know for sure."
The press had gotten wind of the garbage bags, but they'd never released information about the glued-on gag. Gage carefully removed the rope and bagged it. Next, he gently pulled the bag from her head. Her mouth was sealed with a black bandana identical to the one found on Angie. Corinna turned to Nick.
"Let's find out if she had a sex diary, and if Bondage or Scout commented on her page. And I'm going to wake Patrick up. We need something more to go on than two unknown profiles in cyberspace."
She motioned for Dylan to approach. Her brother stared at the body, his face long.
"She's so young.
Do you have a description of Becca Harrison?"
"Long dark hair, blue eyes, 5'4", 105 pounds.
"It fits. Let's run her prints before we call the parents, just to be sure."
Dylan looked at her with compassion. Was he thinking about the day when the police came to the Kincaid house and told them that Justin's body had been found? Every time she had to talk to her parents, she thought about the anguished cry that came out of her sister's throat, a sound that could only be described as the voice of pain itself.
"I'm sorry,"
Dylan now said.
"I'll be okay."
She would. That was her job. And doing the job helped make her okay.
"Look at her."
Corinna pointed toward the victim's body, harshly visible in the lights Gage had set up around the perimeter.
"The MO changed. Why the plastic wrap?"
"The media has always jumped on the similarities between crimes, the so-called signature of a serial killer," Dylan said. "But in truth, killers are always trying to perfect their crime. With every kill, they lose something, part of the fantasy. This is why they start killing in the first place. The mental fantasy is no longer enough to satisfy them. They escalate. Some might rape first, then rape and kill, but the kill itself, while it's a momentary high, leads to depression when it's over. So a killer will change things to keep the excitement high."
"But why plastic wrap?"
Corinna pushed.
"Is this a way to keep evidence off the body?"
"I think that's one purpose, yes," Dylan said.
"And the other?"
This time Nick spoke. He wanted to feel her die, be closer to her when she died.
"The plastic wrap is thinner than garbage bags, and look how carefully he wrapped her. Not bulky. He could feel her beneath the plastic, while still keeping trace evidence, his hair and skin fibers, off her body."
He looked from Corinna to her brother.
"I'm not a shrink, but I'd bet my pension that he had sex with her while she was dying."
Corinna paled.
"That's..."
She was going to say, "That's sick," but the entire case sickened her. She pulled out her cell phone and woke Patrick up at home. told him about the murder.
2 hours, downtown.
Dawn had just crested by the time Corinna and Nick entered police headquarters. The smallest interview room had been converted to the task force headquarters, and Chief Causey had come in early so Corinna and Nick could brief him privately. Then he joined the task force meeting. After Corinna brought everyone up to date on the case, Patrick took the floor.
I woke up the security chief at my journal as soon as Detective Kincaid called about the Harrison homicide. I told him we had enough for a warrant, but if he wanted to pull together the information now, we would appreciate it.
The chief interrupted.
I talked to Stanton this morning. He's getting the warrant as we speak.
Patrick nodded.
The My Journal people are pulling every comment both Bondage and Scout posted in the last 3 months, including the deleted comments that are maintained on the server for 3 months. Beyond that, everything is wiped, unless archived on an individual My Journal user page. There's no way to retrieve it, but 3 months should be enough to establish any pattern.
But is one of these people the killer?
One of the cops in the room asked.
We're not sure, but it's all we have to go on right now. One of the deleted comments scared the first victim enough that she believed someone dangerous knew where she worked,
Corinna interjected.
We're not only focusing on the first victim's online journal. We also have Becca Harrison. The fact that she disappeared from the library Wednesday night and her body was dumped there 30 hours later is significant. We're looking at any connection between Angie and Becca, but on the surface, we haven't been able to find anything other than they both worked in La Jolla.
Becca has no online diary that I could find, but that doesn't mean one doesn't exist, Patrick said. Her parents have been notified, and I'm sending a team to retrieve her home computer this morning. I'll also check the library network. When I get the unique user identification code from my journal for the two people we're interested in, I can run it against any network and know whether they use the library to log on to the My Journal site. I'll go first to the library, then Angie's place of employment, since they have a public network for patrons.
Chief Causey spoke.
I need something for the press. They've already sniffed out that these cases are connected.
He looked pointedly at Corinna.
Sir, they showed up only 30 minutes after I did. The police scanner is not as secure as we would like.
Point taken.
Officer Diaz spoke up.
What happened with the evidence against Stephen Thomas? Or the first Vic's boyfriend, Masterson?
The evidence against Thomas was circumstantial at best, and we can't find anything to link him to the murder. Thomas has been cooperating, turned over all his computer equipment, and came down for a formal interview, Corinna said. Masterson has a solid alibi for Angie's murder, but we're going to talk to him again to confirm his whereabouts on Wednesday between 7 and 9. When Becca Harrison was kidnapped.
Chief Causey spoke, walking slowly around the desk to stand in front of his men and women.
Detective Patrick Kincaid is handling all computer-related aspects of the case, and Detective Corinna Kincaid is heading the investigation. I've approved overtime on this case, so please give them as much time as you can. As you may have heard, Detective Hooper was called up to the appeals court to testify again in the Theodore Glenn case. If you haven't met Sheriff Nick Thomas from Montana, he's over there.
He pointed to Nick, standing in the far corner.
And I've brought him in officially as a police consultant. We don't want the press or the defense attorney to have any reason to slam us when we nail this bastard. Sheriff Thomas has experience with serial killers, and he's already been an asset to our investigation.
Causey turned to Dillon and nodded. Dillon spoke.
I've been working on this case with Detectives Kincaid and Hooper almost from the beginning. Angie Vance's murder was disturbing and showed immediately that we were up against a vicious predator. Now that we have two victims, the evidence is clear. He's not going to stop until we stop him. I'm working up a more formal profile, but Detective Kincaid knows what we're looking for. Going around now is a sheet of the basic characteristics of our killer. But remember, profiling is not a science. It's using what we know of human nature and previous crimes to make an educated guess about the individual capable of these atrocities. One thing I can guarantee, he will act again, and sooner rather than later.
I suspect he already has his next victim in his sights.
Dylan nodded at Corinna, who handed out assignments. Two officers added to e-crimes to help Patrick. One officer to canvass the university. Two officers to interview Becca's friends and family. And two officers dedicated to reviewing like crimes and following up with outside jurisdictions.
Chief Causey is also issuing a warning through the media for young women in the La Jolla area to be cautious, not be out alone after dark for any reason, and to go through the standard safety checklist, Corinna said. Any questions?
Finally, Chief Causey looked everyone in the eye.
Let's get this guy before he strikes again. Dismissed.
Chapter 21. Nick walked with Corinna to the coroner's office.
I'm glad Dr. Chen is willing to come in early and take care of Becca Harrison, Corinna said. You don't have to observe.
I do, he said. Of course he would observe. Knowing the victim helped know the killer. So far, law enforcement hadn't come up with any similar crimes. Nothing in California matched, and so far, the FBI database had come up dry. He couldn't help but think about the butcher's first victim. If the investigators had followed up on every thread, talked with more people, did more legwork, maybe, the killer would have been stopped. Before claiming 21 additional lives. Because the butcher's first kill had been personal. Something starts the chain reaction. Something leads to the first kill. Going back to the first kill of the butcher led them to the killer. If Angie was, as Nick suspected, the first victim of this San Diego killer, it was personal. Something about Angie had specifically set him off. What was it? Her double life? Something else? They walked into the overly air-conditioned laboratory, and Jim Gage, who Nick had met at the crime scene the night before, approached.
I'm assisting Dr. Chen on this one.
He stared at Becca's prepped body on the cold stainless steel table, his expression unusually grim.
You okay?
Fine.
He looked over his shoulder at Nick.
You were right.
About? Though he didn't need to ask.
Her entire body is covered in plastic wrap, except for her vagina. There's residue from a condom and spermicide. I've already sent it to the lab for identification.
DNA?
Corinna asked.
Don't know yet.
Was her body washed?
Yes, but he was rushed this time. There's a lot of soap residue. And get this, there was a head injury.
Maybe he hit her when he abducted her, Nick said.
The butcher lured his victims from their vehicles, then knocked them unconscious. Possibly, but...
Chen interrupted. Rather than speculate, let's observe the body. Corinna gathered her professionalism and looked at the victim as a puzzle, not a person. Becca Harrison's autopsy was as methodical as Angie's, but this time, Corinna focused on similarities and differences. Both victims had been sexually assaulted, including raped with a closed beer bottle. The marks on the inside of the vagina now distinctive. Both had had their mouths glued shut and secured with a black bandana, and had been restrained with white nylon rope. Both had been released from their restraints and thoroughly washed before being killed. Both victims had suffocated in a garbage bag. Both victims were in their late teens. Both victims lived or worked in La Jolla, the upscale community in North San Diego, but still within the city limits. Both had been kidnapped after dark. Angie had been raped both anally and vaginally. Becca, only vaginally. Angie had been imprisoned for more than 48 hours before being killed. Becca, between 24 and 30. While both bodies had been dumped, Becca had been returned to the library where she was last seen. Why had Angie been dumped on the beach? Had Angie gone to the beach after Steve had followed her home? If so, why? Or did the beach hold some significance for the killer?
Corinna noted that the plastic wrap on Becca was a key difference. Dylan and Nick had agreed that the plastic wrap had allowed the killer to get physically closer to his victim, while still giving him a level of protection against leaving evidence on her body. Gage was taking the plastic to the lab to see if he could collect any trace evidence, because plastic attracted hair and fibers.
"We might get lucky here," Gage said. "The plastic garbage bags don't hold fibers as well as plastic wrap. Different properties. And the contamination at the scene with the sand is making any evidence harder to find. I'm going to prioritize this."
"The killer has been so careful with the bodies and not leaving evidence, it seems odd that he'd change his M.O. to a less safe method," Corinna said.
"You have to think like the killer," Nick said. "It's not about protecting him, though he has taken a greater effort than many serial killers to foil forensics."
"If it's not about forensics, what's it about?" Corinna asked.
"His pleasure. His fantasy. It's all about him. On the surface, he gets what he wants, closer to the dying victim. Logically, he's thinking the plastic wrap will prevent evidence transfer. And if he dumped her body on the beach, the sand would contaminate any evidence. But a parking lot isn't the same. Just like the properties of the plastic wrap and garbage bags aren't the same."
"So he made a mistake."
"He's going to realize it," Nick said.
"You think?"
"Eventually." Jim Gage spoke. "He's taking such pains to stymie the forensics investigation, it makes me think that he's in the system."
"We've run like crimes," Corinna said, "and so far nothing. I have two dedicated officers on it now, so we're digging deeper."
Gage said, "Dr. Chen, you said there was another difference between the first and second victim." He nodded and motioned them to a light box against the wall, flipping the switch while dimming the overhead lights at the same time. "The second victim has two head wounds. The first is a faint subdermal bruising, not fatal and likely caused by a hand. See, you can see distinct fingers. It's on the side of the head, as if he slapped her hard. The second is on the lower left quadrant of her skull. I don't see how he could have hit her there. He would have had to swing up with something sharp enough to leave this deep gash." The wound was about 2 inches long, wider in the middle. Gage nodded.
"From the angle, I think she fell."
"How could she fall if she was restrained?" Corinna asked.
Nick spoke up.
"He untied her to wash her, probably in a bathtub. He wouldn't let her walk behind him, so she comes out first and makes a run for it. Maybe slams the bathroom door to delay him, throws something in his path. It had only been a day. She wasn't as weak as Angie. With a burst of adrenaline, she runs."
"But he catches up with her," Gage said, nodding. "Maybe pushes her."
"Look here," Chen said. "This is another faint subdermal bruise, a minor wound in the very back of her head, which might indicate that she was pushed against a wall. No broken skin."
"So?"
Nick used Corinna to demonstrate, taking her by the shoulders and gently pushing her against the wall. "Becca runs, he catches her, and slams her against the wall."
Nick stood very close to Corinna, and she held her breath.
"He's angry, furious that she tried to run. He wants her back in position so he can finish it, but he's mad. Throws her down."
Holding Corinna by the arms, Nick pretended to throw her, going with the momentum to control it.
"Maybe a coffee table, a cabinet, a chair, something with a sharp corner is in the way, and she hits it."
Without letting Corinna hit the ground, he pulled her up. She stumbled, and he caught her, gave her a wry grin.
"Sorry."
She swallowed, nodded, unable to talk. Few men made her feel small and feminine. Nick Thomas was definitely one of them.
Gage was nodding. "I can see it."
Chen concurred. "Holds with the evidence. There's no soap residue in the wound, which suggests it occurred after the washing." "Anything else that's different about this crime scene?"
Corinna asked, finally finding her voice.
Look at her right hand.
Chen lifted the victim's hand, showing deep gashes under her nails.
What did he do to her? Corinna asked.
Cleaned her fingernails with a knife,
Chen answered.
Then doused them in bleach.
Why?
She asked.
Nick answered. Remember that she ran. She's unrestrained and fighting back. What would you do?
Hit, kick, scratch.
She paused.
She scratched him. Were you able to get a sample of his skin?
Jim shook his head.
Doubtful, though we're taking extensive samples from her fingers. The knife turned the ends of her fingers to pulp. The bleach messes with the tests.
Anything else? Nick asked.
Becca Harrison had been a virgin.
Well, that certainly shoots down the theory that she had an online sex diary,
Corinna said.
So where's the connection?
Let's go to the library, Nick said. They should be open by now.
The library wasn't open to the public yet, but several people were inside. Corinna knocked briskly on the glass double doors and flashed her badge when someone looked her way. A petite, silver-haired woman unlocked the door, her eyes red-rimmed. She clutched a pile of damp tissue in one hand.
Is this about Becca?
Yes, ma'am.
The woman's eyes teared again. She let Corinna and Nick in, locked the doors behind them.
I can't believe it. I can't believe it.
Are you the librarian?
The head librarian, yes. Marjorie Kimball.
Corinna introduced herself and Nick, then asked,
Were you working Wednesday?
Yes.
She rubbed the tissue against her eyes.
Please, come in. I called the other staff and volunteers when Mr. Harrison told me Becca had been.
Her voice trailed off.
We were so worried yesterday, but thought for sure there was some logical explanation. At least we tried to tell each other that. Miss Kimball, we'd like to speak with you first, then to the rest of the staff, in private. Is there a room we can use?
She looked around, as if she'd never seen the library before.
We have a meeting room in the back. Will that do?
Perfect.
Corinna let the librarian lead the way. The La Jolla Public Library had been lovingly maintained and upgraded. It was multi-leveled, with skylights in the large reading room, and workstations throughout. Far different from her small neighborhood library, which had been walking distance from the house her parents still lived in. But this library smelled the same, of books, new and old, newspaper, and quiet. Corinna let Miss Kimball give them Becca's schedule. Tuesday and Thursday from 4 p.m. until 8 p.m. Becca had been volunteering at the library for more than a year, since she turned 16. She'd been filling in for a friend on Wednesday. After going through the preliminaries, Corinna asked,
On Wednesday, did Becca tell you she was planning on being picked up or meeting with anyone?
Miss Kimball shook her head.
No. She left promptly at 8.
Has she talked about a boyfriend or special friend?
Again, no.
She didn't date. She's shy around boys. A late bloomer.
Do you know if she had a web page or an online journal of some sort?
She never said.
Did she ever tell you about someone who'd been harassing her or any fears that she was being followed?
No. She was always joyful. That's what I think of when I think of Becca. Joy. On Wednesday, she was just as happy as ever.
This wasn't getting anywhere.
Did she talk to anyone here?
Patrons.
Anyone who was new? A stranger? Someone who wasn't a regular patron?
I don't know. No one I noticed as strange. I don't know everyone who comes in here, but I recognize most of the faces of the regulars.
Okay. Think back to that night. Was there anyone who left either right before or right after Becca? I wouldn't know. I was at my desk, which is in the back of the library. Midge, she's out in the annex waiting, was at the front desk. She would have a better view of everyone who enters.
Nick escorted Miss Kimball out and brought in Midge. They went through the same questions.
Becca talked to everyone, Midge said.
She was younger than Miss Kimball by at least 10 years, but seemed stodgier.
I had to constantly work on her to focus on her job, not chatting. But she's a volunteer,
she said in a what-can-you-do tone.
And on Wednesday? She talked to at least 6 people while she was working. I can't imagine any of them hurting her. Can you describe any men she spoke with? Mr. Sanders and his wife. They come in every Wednesday and Sunday to read newspapers. How old are they? In their 80s.
Forget them, Corinna thought.
Who else? The nice young man who lost his cat. Do you know his name?
No. He comes in a few times a month, in the evenings usually, doesn't have a library card.
And his cat ran away?
She shook her head.
Becca said that someone shot the poor animal. Can you imagine? She was heartsick over it.
Corinna glanced at Nick, and he gave her a brief nod.
When did he leave?
Oh, early. 5, 5:30. I don't really remember.
What does he do when he's here?
Studies.
He's in college?
I think so. I'm not sure. He brings in textbooks and his laptop.
He doesn't use the library computers?
No. He prefers one of the laptop stations in the annex.
Can you describe what he looks like?
Her brow furrowed as she concentrated.
Nice looking. Average. Tall, but not as tall as you,
she pointed to Nick.
A little on the skinny side, but he's very nice, polite, clean-cut. I think Becca had a crush on him, but she was too shy to ask him out, and I think he was too shy to ask her out.
She shook her head.
She was such a sweet girl. About how old would you say he was?
I don't know. Maybe early 20s, maybe younger. Kids look so much more mature these days.
Do you remember his hair color?
Light.
Blonde or light brown?
I don't know. More on the brown side. I'm not really sure.
You don't think. He's not. He can't be. He's just a young man.
As if being a young man meant you couldn't rape or murder.
We don't know right now. We're trying to talk to everyone who spoke to Becca the day she disappeared. We'd like to talk to him. Maybe he saw something.
Oh, right. That makes sense. I can get you the Sanders information.
Do you know if the young man Becca spoke with has a car?
No.
But you're certain he left during the 5 o'clock hour?
Yes. I left at 6 and he'd gone before then.
Do you remember if he looked at any specific book while he was here?
No. He came in about 4, just before Becca came in, and sat at the table near the front of the annex like he always does. He worked on his laptop the whole time, at least from what I saw. I didn't have to clean up his workstation, like I do some people.
Corinna thanked Midge for her time, and continued with the interviews. When they were done speaking with everyone who'd been working Wednesday night, no one else remembered the light-haired young man. They asked Midge to call them if he came in again, and then they looked at the table she'd indicated that he always used. It was a small flat maple table, no drawers, immaculate. A power outlet was within arm's reach. The man could see the entire library, but no one could see his computer screen. Not that that meant anything. Corinna herself never sat with her back to a room or door. Most civilians didn't have that phobia.
I need to put an undercover in here in the evenings,
Corinna said almost to herself.
I'm getting a feeling about this.
It's our only solid lead right now, Nick agreed. Until Gage brings us some physical evidence.
You think he'll come back if he's guilty?
He might think that's the way to not attract attention. Keep up the same routine.